Yes, it is. KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara, and you're tuned in to Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent, covering stuff from the paper, stuff going into the paper, stuff that will be in the paper, all kinds of paper-related stuff. The new issue is out, of course, every Thursday morning, and the show airs every Thursday morning, 8 until 9. My name's Colin Marshall. I've written about books and about KCSB for the Indie. I do the KCSB column every Tuesday morning on independent.com. And of course, I'm here with you 8 to 9 every Thursday morning. Right now, we're hearing one of the cuts organized by pop culture editor Ali Cumingore. This is Anais Mitchell with Wedding Song. She's playing Soho on Friday, July 8th. We have things planned for the show, as always, a little later, talking to one of the winners of the Independent's second annual Sizzling Summer Barbecue Contest. I think I have that right. He's coming on in talking about his pork shoulder. I discussed that dish, in fact, with Georgie Acheson, the food editor, a couple weeks ago. I want to say 2, maybe 3 weeks ago on this show, but if you heard it, you know that pork shoulder is what you want to hear about at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you're going to be hearing about more of it. But first, I'm rejoined in the studio by indie reporter Ethan Stewart, who has been reporting on the development of Naples, or looks like the development that might not be going on in Naples. Ethan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Colin. How are you doing?
Doing pretty well, you?
Okay.
Good deal. Now, Naples, for those who just haven't been paying attention, maybe those who have never left Lower State Street, what is Naples? Where is it?
It's out basically at the easternmost edge of the Gaviota Coast. If you're on Highway 101 and you get past Winchester Canyon exit and get out to the Dos Pueblos Ranch exit, take that exit and look towards the ocean and look towards the mountainside, you're essentially looking at it.
Mm. And it's a good thing to look at.
It is.
If I'm not mistaken.
It's about as beautiful as it gets.
So we're talking about Naples, essentially, this is an undeveloped space, one of the few on the coast in Southern California.
Yeah, it is. And it's a particularly relevant one to local discussions, especially when we're talking about saving the Gaviota Coast, just because it's an important puzzle piece in that whole debate.
Right. Now, let's sketch in that debate a little bit. Let's fill it in a little bit, because people will have heard, no matter what, of the Gaviota Coast, usually brought up. Even if they're not too into going to the coast, I've heard it brought up as this sort of emblem, like, this is something that's got to be saved, it's in danger. They'll hear it brought up as something in danger, primarily. So what is the danger facing the Gaviota Coast?
Well, I think the danger facing it is everything you see when you drive south of here.
Ah, fair enough.
You know, the concrete hell of L.A. and thereabouts. It's beautiful, but beyond its beauty, it's incredibly important. In a biological sense, it's one of the most biodiverse areas in the world. And it's also one of the few true sort of Mediterranean climates in the world. And as such, and then you get into what's going on in the ocean off there. And because the Bight of California, Point Conception, and you get the mixing of the water currents, and the ocean off there is incredibly biodiverse as well. So it's really this just crucial little slice of our world that is only made more crucial by the fact that development surrounds it on all sides. You know, it's right. An island of importance.
Now, you've been covering Naples and the Gaviota Coast for a while, so tell me, over the past however long, I mean, have developers been just kind of sharpening their knives and forks, you know, holding them over this patch of land, like, let me at it, or what's that situation been like?
Well, there's been one guy who's owned it really for the last 12 years, more or less. His name's Matt Osgood.
Yes.
And he had a sort of ever-mutating plan in place and actually got one approved, despite a lot of public outcry a few years back by the county supervisors. But he's never been able to do anything with it after getting approved.
Right. So he could have been building something this whole time that he's after he's gotten it approved, right?
Yeah.
But just hasn't.
He got about 70 luxury homes approved out there.
Mm.
But, you know, just getting that supervisor's approval, though crucial, isn't really the whole ball game.
Right, that you've got to build those homes.
Yeah.
You know, there's a certain little part of the detail there.
Yeah, and you got to get sign off from the California Coastal Commission, and there's a bunch of other sort of permitting stuff that needs to go down before it could happen. And in that time, He ran into a lot more resistance. There were lawsuits filed by folks like the Naples Coalition and the Surf Rider, the local Santa Barbara Surf Rider chapter. And it just kind of got delayed long enough where the economy crashed and various other factors conspired.
Right.
And so now Matt's been foreclosed on. He doesn't own it anymore. A bank from St. Louis does. And that's where we're at. And
now, the luxury homes Matt Osgood intended to build, these, from what I hear people talk about, you know, these didn't seem slated to be like architectural marvels, right? I mean, he just wanted to put a bunch of houses that would be high in value. Is that a correct assessment?
Yeah, in fairness, he did go through the architectural process actually a couple different times to try to make something more appealable. The house sizes did shrink. They went from about 20,000 square feet per house, not including outbuildings like granny cottages and pool houses and garages, down to about 10,000 square feet per house, which is still, you know, I don't know, I think about eight times the size of the average house in the neighborhood. So in fairness, he did try to some degree. I'm not so sure it was his proposed houses per se, at least in their specific design, that sunk his battleship.
And, you know, he's in the story, in your story you have in this issue of The Independent, you have quotes from him, and this developer, Matt Osgood, he seems like, yeah, my battleship sunk. You know, his attitude is like, well, this is over. I mean, good luck developing it. Anybody who's going to do it, but yeah. You know, is that essentially the attitude you got from him?
I think so. I mean, you know, he's been trying for 12 years, and it's not like he'd never developed anything before. So he knew what he was getting into. He's from Orange County. He's done a lot of projects down there. He definitely had faced resistance before. I think he underestimated the will of the people around these parts, you know, to protect their open space, particularly out on the Gaviota. But, you know, it's really the story right now, though Matt is a part of it, it's, for me at least, this particular twist in the road is more about hope than it is about his failure.
Right.
Because what happened last week was really sort of unique, at least in the last 10 years. Because we had the executive board of Surf Rider National, you know, sort of the overarching body of all surf riders. And they were in town for a separate meeting, but they came out to the property and hopped over the barbed wire fence and got to see it firsthand and were really blown away. And it was a hopeful day. And there's been a few field trips out there over the last decade, and hope hasn't been a part of any of those field trips.
Really?
They've been
despair, more like?
Yeah, because it's been all on the development's terms. And you go out there and there'll be story polls or there'll be county people coming along talking about, you know, where this equestrian center and that utility center and that, you know, 15,000 square foot McMansion's going to go. And those tours were really, they just smelled of development because that's what they were all about.
Hmm.
And this was the first time that there was really a presence on that land of people who purely want to preserve it. And that's what the discussion was about. And it actually seemed possible for the first time, at least in the, you know, the 10 years or so that I've been following it. And that, for people who want to see it stay the way it is, that's a pretty significant development.
Now, the side that, you know, this side we're talking about, the one that Santa Barbara Surf Rider is on, the one that the preservationists are on, I want to get an idea of, is it just a matter of not letting anything be built there? I mean, is it as simple as that? That's the goal, just keep it the way it is, don't let anything be built? Or is there anything more complicated to it? Is there just... What I guess I want to know is, are there some crazy maintenance issues here involved in the land, or is it just like, don't build and then we're good?
Yeah, that you raise a good point. I mean, that's always the sort of what now, if you do win and preserve the land in a sort of lasting sense, then it's like, well, who's responsible for the land?
Because yes.
You can't just put several hundred acres out there off Highway 101 and not have some sort of maintenance or security or upkeep or liability for that matter. So that's sort of the trick of the preservation game. I'm not sure they're near that stage yet. But yeah, I mean, for the groups like Surf Rider, the local chapter, and for the Naples Coalition, their attitude all along has been, we don't care who you are. We just don't want to see this place built. I think of particular importance to them is the coastal side of the property, because it's on both sides of the freeway, you know?
Right.
But as far as they're concerned, I think that, you know, what they would like to see is nothing out there other than what nature intended.
Now, do we have any other examples of land, I suppose, perhaps even not coastal, but preserved land to point to and say, we can do it like this or that, like this patch is preserved. Why don't we do the same with Naples?
Well, we've got all sorts of places, you know, like the Wilcox property in Santa Barbara, Elwood out here, you know, not far from where we're talking right
now. Not far indeed.
And, you know, those are places that you can point to and say, we did it. I mean, those are prime spots that people would want homes on, and they don't have them because the people at large fought to protect them. So, yeah, I think Santa Barbara has a lot of success stories. Then we also have places, you know, like Hammond's in Montecito, which was a glorious fight in the 70s and early 80s. And though there still is a little slice of open space there, you know, it's not much bigger than a side yard for a lot of these houses that are proposed. And there's really some of the ugliest architecture this coast knows right in that neighborhood. So we also have, you know, definite examples of what happens when you don't win.
By the way, if you've just tuned in, this is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB 91.9 FM every Thursday morning with you 8 until 9. I'm Colin Marshall speaking with Ethan Stewart, reporter for the Indy, talking about the development, or looking like not development, at Naples. Now, is this all or nothing? Is this developed into McMansions or left pristine? It seems like if you're not familiar with the story, there could be like a compromise, but then it also seems like maybe there can't be, because one house could well ruin it. Like, is it, in a practical sense, one or the other for properties like this?
It's not necessarily the case that it's one or the other. It's complicated, though, in the sense that in order to put just one house out at Naples, for example, you got to get utilities to it somehow. And so therein sort of lies the rub to get the utilities there, the money that would cost, and blah, blah, blah. You're kind of, if you're a developer, you're like, well, I'm not going to make any money if
it's
I just
not worth
build
it,
one.
Yeah.
Moreover, to buy the whole property, I'm not going to make any money if I'm just going to build one.
Is it only bought or sold as a piece? Is it, it's one chunk?
It has been, but it is technically, I mean, that's been Osgood's threat all along, is he could start selling off these lots, because there's an interesting sort of curveball in the whole Naples debate, which makes it super unique. And that's that there's this really old map that has been approved by the courts of California as being a legitimate zoning map for the property.
And how old is this map?
Man.
Yellowed edges, kind of old west looking.
Yeah, it's you know, if I wasn't off coffee right now, I'd probably remember, but I'm on day 7 without caffeine. And
oh my God, and you're doing this.
I'm a little bit slow, but it's, I want to say it's from like 1890 or something like that.
1890, okay, fair enough.
And it basically identifies roughly 270 lots out at Naples. And that's a lot for an area of that size. That's way more than any sort of zoning that exists anywhere else in a neighborhood like that in the county. So the belief of Osgood and the Morehearts, who owned it before him, was essentially that each one of those lots is, you know, legally buildable. Or most of those lots, at least, are legally buildable. And so you have this sort of doomsday situation where, rather than 70 homes or so out there, you could have 270.
Oh, yes.
And presumably those lots are all sellable. Whether or not someone could buy one and then go and get the actual approvals to develop it is a whole nother thing, but they are, you know, sellable. And you'll see them periodically. you know, come up on real estate listings. I mean, they all have technically been on the market in some capacity for the last several years. So, yeah, that's sort of the trick too. And moving forward, if people try to figure out a preservation play, is how do you buy up all of these? Especially now that the bank owns the majority, but Osgood still actually owns three, one of which he has a home on.
Oh yes, right.
So it's tricky, and it probably, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to make any predictions, but it's a messy situation, and it's not going to be easy no matter what. You know, whether it's someone coming in saying, hey, I want to put some homes out there, whether it's someone coming in saying, hey, I actually want to start farming this land like it once was done, or whether it's some group coming in saying, hey, we want to fundraise and buy this place and turn it into, you know, permanently protected open space. Any of those plays are going to be difficult, especially in today's economy.
Now, how did such a big chunk end up in the hands of an Iowan bank?
Oh, it's St. Louis.
St. Louis.
Well, it's who Osgood had his primary loan with to first buy the place.
I see.
And when he defaulted on his payments, they won the day. And so, yeah, it's Naples is owned by a bank from St. Louis.
Do we know anything about what that bank wants to do with what they have? To the extent we can know what a bank wants.
Yeah, but it's tough to figure out. They're not really too interested in talking. I suspect what's happening, and talking to some sort of lower level people who work with the bank and local representatives with them, I suspect what's happening is that they're trying to figure out what exactly they have. I mean, it's this incredible rat's nest of a situation that really very few of us actually understand. And they more or less just inherited it. And they aren't on good terms with Osgood, the guy who probably understands the ins and outs of it as well as anyone.
Right.
So he's not in a position to sort of guide them, nor does he want to, I don't think. They're actually actively engaged in a lawsuit with one another.
Uh-huh.
So they're trying to figure it out. And, you know, what do we have here? What really do we have? And what is the situation? And so that will allow them to sort of intelligently then resell it or whatever it is they choose to do with it. You know, you can't go to market with something and try to sell it or try to find a developer to build it or whatever if you don't even know what it is.
One of the questions that seems to loom over this is that it seems to me one of the reasons people will pay so much for their 20,000 square foot houses or even want them in the first place here is that there is so much, you know, quote unquote, unspoiled land. Like that's so much of the attraction that you eventually start selling away the reason we'll pay so much. You know what I mean? Is that a factor in this at all? People are thinking about?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's beautiful country out there. And people want a part of that. You know, I mean, that's
right. In a
weird way. And, you know, a lot of people probably disagree with me for this, but I think that the guy who wants to develop it and the person who wants to protect it have a lot more in common than they're willing to admit to one another. Sure, one of those people, you know, walks around with a chip on their shoulder like, hey, I'm doing this for the good of the public, while another one of them walks around with a sort of chip on their shoulder saying, hey, I'm an American. I'm a capitalist.
Right. They both have, they feel they have right on their side.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but what they also both have on their side is an undeniable sort of recognition of what a special spot it is.
Yeah.
And
else, why would they fight over it?
Yeah. And that's something that I think is really important. And I think it's something that gets lost a lot in the back and forth and the drawing of battle lines and the sort of us versus them mentality. And it really came home to me when it's in the story, but when I was talking to Osgood this week, he said something and he basically said, hey, if I'm not the one building it, I don't want this place built just as much as the next guy.
Right.
And that was just such a, you know, sort of perfect turn of events. For this guy to say, who's been trying his pants off to build the place for over 10 years, you know, so it just goes to show what a thin line it is. between those two ideas.
Now, anybody who's read your stories or who's heard you on this show before knows, you know, you're a surfer. You write about a lot of outdoors to enjoy, the outdoors you can enjoy in Santa Barbara. And so correct me if I'm wrong, it wouldn't be too much to assume that you're on the preservation side of this yourself, you know, if someone was really putting you to it. But now you're in the role of a reporter. You have to get into a reporter's mindset and report on both sides. You know, can you tell us a little bit about the experience of that?
Yeah, it's tricky for sure. I don't really like people, so I think that, yeah, I would love to see it empty. I mean, that's how I came.
I'm not anti-capitalist. I'm anti-people.
Yeah. So it's, I'd love to see it stay untouched. But at the same time, I also know the importance of property rights. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's an interesting thing happening all over this country these days, especially in California, and you know, rights of all kinds are being trampled, oftentimes with good intentions, but they're still being trampled. And that's something we got to be wary about. And I think you have to sort of steep in your knee jerk reaction a little bit and wonder something, say, hey, this person did pony up $60 million and that's more money than I can ever fathom in my life. And
yeah,
there's risk with that.
Change, yeah.
Yeah. There's major risk with that. And so they are entitled to something. How you get there is a totally different thing, and,
yes.
And what that something ends up being is a totally different thing. But so that is part of my view too. And so I think that, I don't know, I try to be fair in it. You know, I don't agree with the vision I don't think anyone would have for that land, if they want to build on it. But at the same time, that doesn't mean I think it's wrong per se.
Hmm.
And it's important to carry that distinction, especially in my line of work. And you know, there's legally buildable lots out there. They're on the books.
Right. They're on that old map.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, that is an undeniable fact. And when those things exist, there also exists a very real possibility of there being building. You may not like it, but it's a possibility. And if you're inclined to preserve it, really your only lasting option is to play the role of a quote-unquote developer, buy the place, and then turn it over, you know, in permanence to some sort of holding company or whatever that you know, create this conservation easement. And we're not there yet, but really that's the, for those of us in this world that don't want to see Naples or anywhere in the Gaviota built, that's really the only way to get there. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. It's, you know, there is no time like right now, probably. I mean, before Osgood owned it, the Morehearts had it. It's been in ownership of people who want to build it for half a century.
Hmm.
Now it's in ownership of a bank who really will just go with the best deal.
Right.
So if you're a preservationist and you've got the best deal, there you go. Now is the time.
And you can read more about this present moment with what's going on in the seems like not development of Naples in Ethan Stewart's article in this current issue out this morning of the Santa Barbara Independent. Ethan, thanks for taking the time to come on Poodle Radio.
Thanks, Colin. It was fun.
This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. Stay tuned. We're talking about some pork shoulder just on the other side, which won a segment of the competition known as the second annual Sizzling Summer Barbecue from the Independent. In the meantime, some more tracks if you enjoy them. I've got concert info just on the other side. Stay tuned.
There goes a week or one.
It's KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Colin Marshall. You are tuned in to Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. And of course, that was the track wrangled, as always, by the Indies pop culture editor Ali Cummingore. Tamer Animals was the song. Other Lives was the band. They're playing Soho in downtown Santa Barbara on Tuesday, July 5th. And of course, there's more concert info from the Independent in the paper, on the website, or wherever, if that's the sort of thing that interests you. Now a cut from a band I've been seeing a lot on lately. A lot of pictures, although now that I think about it, maybe just the same picture a lot. This band is Best Coast. The cut is Honey, the album is Crazy for You. Gonna tell you who, well, when they're playing, where they're playing, in just a moment on Poodle Radio, KCSB 91.9 FM.
Oh,
is KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Colin Marshall. This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent here on KCSB every Thursday morning, 8 until 9. Hope to have you here every single time, because if you didn't show up to your radio or wherever, or your web stream on kcsb.org, you would miss a discussion about slow-smoked pork shoulder, jalapeno and green chili corn waffle, horseradish coleslaw, and homemade barbecue sauce. You recognize that because we talked about it a couple weeks ago when food editor George Yatcheson was on the program, on the show, whatever you want to call it, talking about the second annual Sizzling Summer Independent Barbecue Contest. Well, that dish, let me tell you, won one of the divisions. It was that good, apparently. And here with me, I have the maker of that dish, Aaron Ives. Aaron, welcome to Poodle Radio.
Good morning.
Now, you mentioned earlier, I just want to get this out of the way, you're familiar with the station. You had a show on KCSB. What was that show like?
It was a lot of fun. It was actually my buddy Juan Monroy's show, and I just kind of helped him out with it. And now my buddies Jason and Jeff have a show out here.
Indeed. Face the Music. And that just changed nights, I think, recently, but that's on the KCSB schedule. And I wrote a KCSB column about that. That's on independent.com. But we're here to talk about pork shoulder. Tell me a little bit more about this dish, because I brought it up to George. I was saying there's this dish that looks so elaborate. It looks like this sort of wild thing with like stuff piled on it. I just pictured, like, what is it actually like?
It's kind of my take on a slow smoked pork shoulder sandwich that you'd find in the South. I got a lot of family in Memphis, Tennessee, and some of my best times are going down there and eating with my brother and my mom and dad, and just having a lot of fun. I got a lot of good friends down there too. And I think I just ended up kind of missing it so much. I was like, I just got to learn how to make this myself. And, you know, after poisoning my friends a few times, I think I may have it down. I've been working on it with my buddy Chuck Haynes for a couple of years now.
Tell me about the process of learning to master this. I mean, what are the main challenges of getting this stuff right?
You know, it's a lot of trial and error, so it's just making sure that the pork comes out tender and delicious as you possibly can. And it takes time. You know, it's not like throwing a steak on a grill and having it done in 5 minutes. It's more of it's hours, you know, and I think the process is as important as the final outcome, like what you get. And mine's a little bit different because, like, in the South, they'll serve pulled pork on just plain white bread, and it's delicious, and I like that. But I wanted to do something, I guess, a little bit fancier, a little bit more Californian, if you will, you know. So
indeed, and I want to talk about what that means in this context. But also, tell me about the ones that what went wrong in the previous iterations that you had to work on correcting. I mean, what are the factors that just really, if you are starting out, this is what you're going to mess up. You got to make peace with it. You got to get past it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I make my own rub. So there is, I don't even know how many incarnations of rub for pork and pork butt and ribs that I went through until finally I've got enough kind of secret ingredients in there that make it different, kind of, you know, let it stand out from other stuff. But I think in the early days, I wasn't getting as much flavor in the pork as I really wanted it to have. And ultimately I ended up doing an injection. I think the injection helps out a lot, but I went through days that I would try brining it. I'd brine it in all kinds of different stuff, I wouldn't do anything to it. I'd just buy it at the store, put a rub on it, and throw it on the smoker. And I think it, you know, you got to go through a lot of stuff like that to end up with something that, you know, you're proud of.
What exactly is involved in injecting pork?
I use apple juice, peach juice, sugar, salt, a little bit of Worcestershire, and a little bit of vinegar. And it just really, and then I take a big syringe.
Is it as simple as it sounds? You just literally, like,
that's right. It's just
wherever,
just
inject it in? Get it into the interior?
Yeah, right into the interior, and I usually keep it in the plastic bag that it comes in, so it doesn't get everywhere, but it'll literally fill up with juice. So I just keep injecting all over it until, you know, you push in one and juice squirts out of one of the other holes.
Now, how long, I mean, not how long, but when did you sort of realize that your pork shoulder was going to be a contender for a contest like the second annual Sizzling Summer Barbecue Contest from the Indy.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I don't think I don't have it mastered yet. I still think it's in the middle of a learning process, but I think that I think it's pretty good. I mean, I think it was probably about six or eight months ago. I was pretty impressed with what I got, and you know, there was none left. I think.
Oh, I see. That's like, the true marker.
Yeah. Once you're not, you know, bagging up leftovers, I think that you might be okay to go try it out at a contest.
Now, this brings up an issue that I'm curious about, because can you go by your impressions and, you know, the words of your friends, or do you have to go by, oh, well, they ate it all, now I know? Like, can you go by act, or can you judge by someone's word?
I think I'm pretty serious about it, so I think all my friends do let me know. I think they're like, oh yeah, this is really good, but not as good as the last one you did, but it seems like lately it's been, whoa, dude, this is the best yet. This is serious. Right. So I kind of think I have the way I want to do it down now, and it's, everybody seems to be happy with it.
So they'd been giving it to you straight up all along, so you knew you were getting feedback. You know, it's a hard thing to genuinely extract from somebody, isn't it? Like, just when you're serving to someone who's not your inner core of barbecue friends, you know, it's just like, how do I know? You know, are they just saying it's good? Like, what are they? You know what I mean, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, at first it was pretty loose, and you know, making your own barbecue sauce is a weird thing. It's trying to hit that balance of sweet, savory, and enough tang in it to give pretty much any food a kick. And I was playing that one pretty loose until my friend Chuck just started writing everything down. So and man, things got progressively better from there, because
you take the alchemy away.
Yeah, I'd have a place to start next time, I think, and now we got, you know, a sauce that I think is unbeatable.
Now I want to know about your experience in different food cultures, because I think the article mentions you have roots in Oklahoma, if I'm not mistaken,
yep.
And you mentioned Memphis food culture and enjoying that so much. And bringing a bit of Memphis here into the Californian food culture, which is a very different thing, and I mean, might well get made fun of in a place like Memphis, you know? And so, is this a matter of taking a piece of Memphis, getting it, making your version of it, and getting it here, and then having Californians be impressed because it is a piece of sort of genuine regional pork shoulder from somewhere else? Or is it a matter of integrating it with kind of what we expect to be eating in California? You know, I saw a lot of bacon wrapped things and, you know, various kinds of mango chipotle in these contests. So what's the story there?
I don't know. I just kind of made, like on this contest, I just kind of made a dish that I wanted to try. And, like, I'm not a big, I don't like cornbread very much, but I make this corn waffle that is really sensational.
Right. I want to know about that waffle. why a waffle?
Texture. I'm all about the texture, and it gets a real nice crispness on the outside of it. And it does serve to be piled stuff on pretty well, you know, so.
If you're piling.
Yeah, if you're piling.
There's a base. Well,
exactly, yeah. And then I'm not a coleslaw guy either. So this recipe for coleslaw it's weird. There's a lot of weird stuff in that that you wouldn't normally find in coleslaw, but I think that lends itself to being really good, because not being that much of a coleslaw guy, I really like it, and then I know people that are coleslaw people that really like it also.
Even the coleslaw purists have to admit.
Yeah.
Now, what do you put it in that you would think would offend them?
Horseradish.
Yeah, okay.
And there's a ton of it in there, and it just doesn't sound like it would work at all, but it works so good.
And this was a trial and error type thing?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, definitely.
By the way, if you just tuned in, I'm speaking with Aaron Ives, who won a division of the Independent Second Annual Sizzling Summer Barbecue Contest with his pork shoulder. It's got a corn waffle, it's got horseradish coleslaw, it's got barbecue sauce he made. It's, you know, even though it's the kind of thing that you wouldn't necessarily think you'd want to hear about at 8 in the morning, I do actually, now that, you know, it's not a breakfast food, but, you know, I'm down with it. Now,
it's served on a waffle.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's served on a... I didn't think about that, but yeah, if it's on a waffle, technically it's breakfast.
That's right.
Now, it's fascinating to me sort of the mechanics of this contest when I bring in George Yacheson, the food editor, to talk about it. He's been in before. You have to think about you have to think about what when you're preparing a dish for this specific type of occasion where there's these food judges and they're all getting certain portions and they're trying it amidst all the other dishes. I mean, is that something you can think about, or is it just like submit the dish however they want to have it, cool, whatever, I'll roll the dice?
Well, I think on this competition, it may have been a little bit different than, like, ultimately my goal is to have a competition barbecue team that goes to, like, California Barbecue Association events and stuff. And this one's a little bit different than that because we did most of the preparation for it at home, then brought it up to Whole Foods, and there's a little staging area set up so we get to finish our dish there and present it to the judges. I'm sorry, I lost the question in there somewhere.
Yeah, I said too many things in the question, so I sort of piled on, as you would pile on a horseradish on a waffle. But it's the idea that the context the judges eat the food in, because it's like, I don't know what position your dish came in as far as the order, but it's like they're eating one type of pork, another type of pork, then there's yours, and then there's something else entirely. They're eating it in smaller portions than they would be as just a meal. It's a highly different setting than just sitting down to dinner. So is that something that was in your mind? Was it something that was in your mind at all when you were getting this thing ready for them?
Yeah, I think, I looked at the order and I was like, well, they ate, I think, 15 things before they got my dish in front of them.
You're going to be number 16 barbecue dish in front of them.
Like, oh, geez, you guys are not going to be very hungry by the
right.
By the
so you've got to be different.
Yeah, it was different, and mine definitely looked different than the other stuff. And it's like a small plate, you know, it was a quarter of a waffle. So each person got a quarter of a waffle and then just a small pinch of the pulled pork. But yeah, it was you got to definitely take that into consideration. You put a giant thing in front of these people that have been eating for an hour and a half, and it immediately, I think, would become unappetizing.
One of the things that I talked to George about when he was in here was the division between the pro and amateur sides of the game, and is the food different? Like, or is it just a way to divide up the contest? And from what he said, you know, it's all good. This is all good stuff. It may be different kinds of experimentation, but, I mean, what did you have a sense of what the context you were in as far as the other dishes was like? I mean, first there's the way the judges are eating them, but, you know, what, and I don't even want to put it in the sense of what you were up against, but in terms of just what else was around, I mean, could you find your way through to draw inspiration from anything there, or was it all just like, man, I hope no one whips out something really great in number, say, 14 or number 17?
There was a lot of good looking stuff there. I mean, there was a lot of,
did you get to try anything else yourself?
Yeah, I got to try a bacon wrapped date drizzled with honey.
Speaking of the California.
And it was delicious. It was, yeah. I was pretty impressed with that. but I mean, just looking at what else was up there was very interesting. And, the person who won the pro entree did at a Vietnamese, chicken sandwich. I think it was chicken, or it might have been pork, but I it looked amazing. I really like the sandwiches too. But yeah, there's a Coca-Cola injected tri-tip also that,
yes,
I wanted to try.
I mean, I don't know about you. You'll know more about this barbecue culture, but that's a thing you do, right? Like Coca-Cola as a marinade and whatnot. It's not a thing like a lot of people do, but that's a legitimate tactic, right?
Yeah, I think,
how legitimate is it, I suppose?
Get something in there, it's just going to break it down and make it tender, I think. So, you know, it sounded like a great idea to me. I mean, I use grape soda in my barbecue sauce, so it's like using uncommon ingredients to achieve maximum flavor, I think, is key.
Now, you mentioned a little bit about the future of, you know, where you want to take this next, but so for someone who wants to rise up in this world, in this, you know, world where a good pork shoulder can win you competitions, I mean, what's the pathway for this?
Oh man, I don't know. I think I just got to go try to do it, you know,
and right, yeah.
I'll come back in a year and let you know, but it seems weird. And the whole dynamic of competition barbecue really seems like an odd thing, because there's no real money in it. So it's all these people doing it for a hobby, and it's kind of an expensive hobby.
Right.
But man, it's a lot of fun. This last year I went out and helped on a team at the Memphis and May Festival. And it was just a really good time. We just did ribs. There's a whole bunch of different categories. Mm. And it was for a restaurant that that basically does it as PR, you know, and it's right. Get people in here and give them some ribs and tell them to go get more ribs at my restaurant. But it was still just fun to be able to walk around and see what it's all about. And it really is just all about having fun.
And I would imagine if you're doing a competition in California and then a competition deep in the heart of barbecue country, that's two different things entirely, right?
Right. Yeah.
How different?
I don't know, because I've never been to a California competition except for the one at Whole Foods, and that was definitely different. But
yeah,
I'm excited to get out there with some of my friends and just, you know, I don't have like a pro rig or anything. I'm using like a Big Green Egg, and my buddy Chuck has a Big Green Egg, and Jason just got this new Weber Smoky Mountain. So we got three small smokers that we're gonna take out and just do whatever we can, I think, and have fun doing it. I got some guys that are really interested in helping me out and hanging out and making good barbecue and having fun. And I, you know, I'm excited for that.
It sounds exciting. And it's also, you know, the nice thing about it is I get the sense that from what you've said, you don't need one of these stainless steel monsters that's like $5,500. And, you know, it's not a matter of you'll get the better food from the more expensive barbecue rig. Like it's about something different. It's about something in the technique more so than the actual King of the Hill type barbecue rigs, right?
Right. I mean, well, I don't know.
it seems that way, though. I mean, I don't want to force you to answer from experience you don't have, but more so from experience of just kind of existing in that world. I mean, even from eating the stuff, like you don't necessarily say, well, wow, great. I thought I was going to eat something off a Weber, but now I'm going to eat something off an enormous propane, stainless steel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. I mean, I'm just trying to explode some maybe misconceptions someone would have about barbecue.
Yeah, I think you're right. In one sense, I mean, there's not many guys are using like a propane based cook or anything. So it's all these giant trailers that you may see at a competition. That's all charcoal or wood. So it's people just burning like sticks of hickory to maintain that 250 degrees.
And the material you're burning probably is a huge thing too, right? Yeah, that's as much of a choice as the meat itself.
Right, yeah, it's a very important thing. I use a lot of hickory and pecan or hickory and apple with pork. And then if I'm doing like any tri-tip or anything like that, I'll use oak and pecan. But yeah, it's pretty interesting.
And finally, I just want to ask about the material itself, you know, your canvas, the pork shoulder. I think people who have eaten it might not even know what the qualities of that are. I mean, they'll maybe look at their own shoulder and say, well, that's just a bone, isn't it? I mean, pork shoulder, cooking with pork shoulder, what are the strengths of that?
Well, it's a very inexpensive cut, I think. It's, you know,
that's a strength. Yeah, if you're doing 100 trials, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big strength.
It's kind of one of those things where it's the traditional barbecue pulled pork cut. So it's either a whole shoulder or a shoulder that's cut into two parts. One's called the picnic and one's called the butt or the Boston butt. And I usually just, you know, around here it's real easy to get Boston butts. You get those, you throw them on the smoker, they got a lot of fat on them, you cook them for a long time, the fat melts out of them, and it leaves you with this like really tender, delicious piece of pork. I mean, it's good.
Now, if people want to eventually one day eat the kind of pork you've been preparing, you know, what do they do? Watch for your name in barbecue competitions, or what's the best way they can just get aware?
I don't know yet. Like, I don't know where I'm going to be able to take it yet. My buddy Colin and I have talked about doing some late night stuff, but we don't, you know, I do photography and video. I don't, I don't know the ins and the outs of doing like
a completely different industry.
Yeah. I got a lot of friends that are chefs, though, so I might just need to be talking to them. But you never know. It's like I'm real happy doing my photography and video stuff and having this crazy hobby that people enjoy. But, yeah, eventually someday I'd like to get something out there for some people to be able to give me money for.
You're going to at least get a video about this up at some point?
Yeah, I mean, that's not a bad idea. Start a video series on how to make your own barbecue.
Right, don't give away your secrets, because you need your secrets, but, you know.
The whole thing is you can have secrets, that's all right, but it's like, you know, nobody just wants to take what you've done and then go out and just make that themselves and call it their own.
Right. So, no fun. Like no fun.
Yeah. It's, you know, I don't have the whole secret thing. It's like already the sauce, there's so many steps involved that I think anybody looking at the recipe would just be like, Oh, that's a little daunting. Yeah. I don't
want I was going to make it.
Going to lose a whole Saturday like this.
Yeah, God, I had plans. You know, you got to make your own secrets in barbecue,
yeah.
It seems like.
Yeah, I think so.
I've been speaking with Aaron Ives, who was one of the winners of the Independent Second Annual Sizzling Summer Barbecue Contest with his pork shoulder, the corn waffle, the homemade barbecue sauce, the horseradish coleslaw. Am I missing anything there?
No, I think you got it.
Excellent. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB 91.9. I think we got just enough time for one more cut. And by the way, Best Coast, who I last played, they're going to be playing where? Looks like Soho, Sunday, July 10th. And now we're going to hear from Otmar Liebert. This is Borasca, and he's playing with his band Luna Negra on in Soho, there we go, not on top of it, on Thursday, June 30th. Hope to have you here every Thursday, 8 a.m. until 9 on Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent, right here on Santa Barbara's only radio station, KCSB 91.9 FM.